facts, candid conversations, and some levity to lighten your day. This is the Cale Clark Show on Relevant Radio.
Welcome, welcome, welcome. It is Thursday, April the 15th. I'm losing track of which day it is, I gotta tell you. 2021, all the days meld together. I'm so glad to spend them with you on Relevant Radio. 1-888-914-9149 is the number to call. I always have to check the calendar on my computer. Like, what month is this again? All the COVID months seem the same. 1-888-914. It's like Groundhog Day. 1-888-914-9149. You can also tweet at me at Cale Clark, C-A-L-E, Clark with an E. At Cale Clark is the show account. At Cale Clark Show is the show account. And you can check that Twitter account because producer Lucas Holt put up a great little tweet earlier today. Because I guess it's World Art Day. It's World Art Day. So he was asking everyone to share their favorite images of Our Lady. And quite a few people responded. So keep it up. Keep it up. That's at the show account at Cale Clark Show. And our email address is cale@relevantradio.com if you have a question or comment. And you're going to want to email us because guess what? Tomorrow, on Friday, it's an AMA day. It's an Ask Me Anything day. So you can get your questions in through Twitter. You can tweet at me now. Get started. Get your shot in there. You can also email us or you can call in tomorrow as well for the Ask Me Anything program. We'll talk about what's on your mind to be sure. But of course, you can call today too. And today is a momentous day. It's Jackie Robinson Day. Because on this day, in 1947, Jackie Robinson broke the color barrier in Major League Baseball. A big moment in American history, to be sure. And on this day, every team in Major League Baseball, all the players will wear 42 in their on their uniforms to honor Jackie Robinson. Of course, that was his number. And lots of celebrations are planned all across the major leagues. But one thing that a lot of people don't know about Jackie Robinson is his strong Christian faith. And really, that was what enabled him to endure all he had to endure. But here's some clips of Jackie Robinson in action.
And here comes Robinson, trying to steal home. He's safe, says the ump. He's out, says Yogi Berra. And brother, is Yogi hopping. Jackie Robinson steps in against Ford. Deep into left center, Irv Noren races after Robinson's blast. Jackie really teed off on Ford.
Every game has its heroes. One of them certainly was Robinson.
Yeah, some highlights from the 1955 World Series, and Jackie Robinson famously stole home in Game 1 of the 1955 series. And Yogi Berra, of course, catcher, the ever-quotable Yogi Berra of the New York Yankees, still thinks that he is out. But he was safe. He was safe. And a lot of people, as I said, don't know much about the private side of Jackie Robinson. When he was born on January the 31st, 1919, in rural Georgia, his mother, Maley, said, "Bless you, my boy. For you to survive all that you're going to have to go through, God will have to keep his eye on you." And little did she know how prophetic that would be. There's a couple of books that have been written about Jackie Robinson's faith. One of them is written by a journalism professor from Indiana University named Chris Lamb. And it's called Jackie Robinson, A Spiritual Biography. And there's also a guy named Ed Henry who wrote a book called 42 Faith. 42 Faith, of course, referring to his jersey number. And I remember Father John Ubell, when he was on the program recently, talking about his baseball card collection. And he had a prized Jackie Robinson, I think it was a rookie card, a Jackie Robinson rookie card that he was selling to raise money for charity for Catholic schools. And he talked about that book when he was on the show not too long ago. And in these books, the authors talk about how really the secret ingredient, as they call it, in Jackie's success was really his faith. And he wasn't necessarily the best possible player candidate in terms of just pure skill to break the color barrier from the Negro Leagues. There were lots of other players who might have been better stats-wise, but really no one was a better choice. So obviously, Jackie Robinson was a fine player in his own right, to be sure, an excellent player, but he had the character to endure the abuse that he had to endure. And he also had the faith to get him through as well. The incredible stress that he had to go through. People shouting racial epithets at him all the time. People threatening his life. And that did grind him down and really took its toll on him over the years. After he retired, he battled diabetes, eventually blindness as a result of the diabetes. And he actually died in 1972 of a sudden heart attack. But his faith was what sustained him really through everything. And when he was signed by Branch Rickey, of course, the general manager of the Dodgers, Jackie and Branch Rickey both had a common faith background. They weren't Catholics, of course, but they were both Methodists. And in 42 Faith, Jackie Robinson is quoted as talking about almost a divine intervention that he felt was happening in his life that helped him to get through all the challenges that he had to endure. And he said this, and I quote, "Somebody else might have done a better job, but God and Branch Rickey made it possible for me to be the one, and I just went on in and did the best that I knew how." And really, his faith kind of came alive when he was in his teenage years. His mother, Maley Robinson, left her husband in Georgia because he was a bit of a philanderer, unfortunately. And she moved her family, her five children, to Pasadena, California, when Jackie was only 6 months old. And one of the reasons why they went to California was not just to get away from her husband and his cheating ways, but also they wanted to escape the oppressive bigotry that they found in the South. But obviously discrimination exists everywhere, and they found it out in California as well. And unfortunately, when Jackie was young, he started to go down the wrong path. He got involved with a gang in Pasadena. He was getting involved in fights, brushes with the law. And one day, there was a young minister at the Scott United Methodist Church by the name of Reverend Carl Downs, who got involved in Jackie's life. And he got a hold of him and said that all of his talents would go to waste if he didn't make a clean break from this gang that he was becoming affiliated with. And for whatever reason, he was able to get through to Jackie Robinson, and he became a bit of a mentor to him, a bit of a father figure, if you will, because he was being raised, of course, at that time by a single mom. And he was able to bring Jackie into the Methodist Church, and he began practicing his faith. And it's so important for all of us, of course, to have mentors in our lives, people that can see what we're capable of, people that can help us to flourish and just really believe in us. And that's what really Jackie found in Reverend Downs, made a huge difference in his life, and often he would credit him for his success. And here's what Jackie Robinson said about Reverend Carl Downs. He said, quote, "He would find a way of applying a story in the Bible to something that was happening in real life. He didn't preach. He didn't talk down to me like so many adults did. He didn't try to view me from some holy distance. He was in there with you," end of quote. And in fact, Jackie actually started teaching Sunday school eventually, and this was when he was attending UCLA. So his faith was really growing, his faith was increasing, and he would need that when he was breaking the color barrier in 1947. Nobody ever faced the kind of pressure and abuse that he did in professional sports. Pitchers would try to injure him purposely. They would throw at his head all the time, and back then they didn't wear hard plastic batting helmets either. Base runners would intentionally spike him with their metal cleats sliding into second base. Spectators would, of course, call him vile names. Threats would come in the mail every single day. But his faith was what kept him going. And Jackie Robinson's wife, Rachel, said that all throughout that rookie year in Brooklyn in 1947, every night, he would get down on his hands and knees and pray before he went to bed. And he would say to her, "This is the best way to get close to God." And so, actually, believe it or not, even before he joined the Dodgers, his faith was really on full display. When he was in the Negro Leagues, he played for the Kansas City Monarchs. And he would openly scorn his teammates who would often be hard drinking, promiscuous. And at one time when he was out with them, he took a glass of scotch that they were drinking and he threw it into a fireplace where it kind of, he wanted to demonstrate how awful alcohol abuse was. And, you know, it just kind of went up in flames. And he would also amaze his teammates because he would tell them, "I'm not going to have sex until I get married." And they just could not believe that. They were just dumbfounded by this guy. So he was obviously a really high character guy. And that's why he was the perfect person for Branch Rickey as he wanted to integrate baseball. And Branch Rickey also, the famous general manager of the Dodgers who brought in Jackie Robinson, he also, as I mentioned, was a Methodist, and his faith was super important to him. In fact, he promised his mother, Branch Rickey did, when he began his career in baseball as a player and then later as an executive, he said, "I won't go to the ballpark on Sundays. I promise. I will never set foot in a ballpark on a Sunday. I will keep my focus on God. I will honor the Sabbath." Well, when Branch Rickey and Jackie Robinson met up at the offices of the Brooklyn Dodgers in the summer of 1945, when they're kind of hatching this plan, Branch Rickey told Jackie, "I want to sign you." And Jackie was 26 years old at the time. But he said, "Listen, I have to have a special, unique individual who's going to be able to handle the strain. There's going to be a lot of indignities that are going to be piled on you. And I'm looking for," he said, "I'm looking for a ball player who has enough guts not to fight back." And then Branch Rickey grabbed a book off of his bookshelf, and that book was published in the 1920s. It was A Life of Christ by Giovanni Papini. And he opened that book to a certain page, and he read these words of Jesus to Jackie Robinson: "Whoever shall smite thee on the cheek, turn to him the other also." And of course, Jackie Robinson, he knew his Bible pretty well. And he said to Branch Rickey, "Well, Mr. Rickey, I've got two cheeks, so I should be able to turn the other one." And later on, Branch Rickey actually said that, in a sense, Jackie Robinson was almost, he quote, almost Christ-like, end of quote, in his ability to rise above the abuse that he had to endure and never retaliate. And so, really, I mean, all of us have to be very Christ-like, not almost Christ-like, but we really do have to be. This is what the word Christian means. It means little Christ. We always have to be conformed and be formed day by day more into the image of Christ and be that witness to the people around us. But of course, Jackie Robinson was human. He admitted that privately there were a lot of times that he wanted to just punch a guy who was, you know, harassing him or calling him names. And he said it was actually a lot harder to turn the other cheek and refuse to fight back than it would have been to exercise a normal reaction. But it works, because sooner or later, when you turn the other cheek, it does bring a sense of shame on those who attack you. And that sense of shame is often the beginning of progress. In other words, if he had fought back, it just would have made things worse. There are many cases where he probably had every right to do so, but he didn't. He showed a lot of restraint. And that's a great lesson. And hopefully the spirit of Jackie Robinson can help us at this time when obviously there's a lot of deep divisions still to this day in the United States of America. Now, one thing that's interesting, too, there's a bit of a Canadian connection to Jackie Robinson, which a lot of people don't know. Before Jackie Robinson went to the Brooklyn Dodgers, he spent a year in Montreal, because the Montreal Royals were the farm team, the AAA farm team of the Brooklyn Dodgers. And the Robinson family's experience in Montreal was a world of difference from what they had experienced in the United States. And in fact, just prior to going to Montreal, Jackie Robinson, who had just gotten married to Rachel, I think they were married for about 2 months, and they went to spring training in Florida. And they endured a lot of abuse during that spring training year. And then they went straight from there to Montreal. And in 1982, the Major League Baseball All-Star Game was played at Olympic Stadium in Montreal. And it was covered by ABC Sports. And Rachel Robinson was interviewed before the game in Montreal. She came back for this game. Obviously, Jackie had died back in 72. But in 1982, 10 years later, she came to Montreal for the All-Star Game. And prior to the game, she was interviewed by the great Howard Cosell.
When we arrived in Montreal, and I, as a 23-year-old young woman, had to go look for an apartment, and approached a neighbor on De Gaspé Street, and she opened the door, and she welcomed me, greeted me warmly, told me to come in, granted me the apartment, without any hint of discrimination. It was my first encounter with an atmosphere where there was no discrimination, where we were totally supported, warmly. And the love that we took from Montreal really sustained us in the more difficult days when we didn't have that kind of support. And so coming home to Montreal, to me, is coming back to really the birthplace of my belief in brotherhood. I really believe it can happen.
Wow, that's incredibly touching that she said her time in Montreal really was the birthplace of her belief in brotherhood. Wow, and it's not that there aren't problems in Canada. We have problems up here as well. But the problems were a little bit different in Canada, especially in the province of Quebec when the Robinsons came there. Actually, probably most of the conflict was between English and French-speaking Canadians and between Catholics and Protestants. It was more of a religious fight than something to do with the issue of race, which really wasn't there. And they were so shocked by this. They were so surprised by the way they were treated. And that allowed Jackie to play a lot of great baseball with peace. And with the Montreal Royals, they had an incredible season, an absolutely amazing season. And they actually went to what was called the Little World Series, which is the minor league World Series that year. And Jackie just tore it up. The Royals had a record of 154. And at the time, he was 27 years old. Robinson led the league in batting average with 349. Runs scored as well, was tops in the league, 113. He stole 40 bases, drove in 66 runs, and struck out only 27 times. Not bad. Not bad at all. And also another amazing thing happened to the Robinson family in Montreal. Rachel became pregnant with their first child, Jackie Jr., who tragically was later killed in an automobile accident when he was only 24 years old. But when Rachel began showing with her pregnancy, there was a French-Canadian family that lived above them. In the apartment above them, and there were eight children in that family. And the kids would always carry the groceries for her as she was pregnant. The women would come over in the neighborhood and help her sew her maternity gowns. They would bring her food. They said she needed to eat more meat while she was pregnant. And whatever they were eating, it certainly worked as the Royals made the Little World Series. And they played against that year the Louisville Colonels. And that was one of only two teams that were below the Mason-Dixon line in the minor leagues. And the series, that little World Series, was supposed to open in Kentucky, in Louisville, but Jackie Robinson wasn't allowed to stay with the team in the team hotel. And there was some question whether the Montreal Royals would even show up for the series because of this, but they were able to find a place for Jackie to stay. And the Louisville owners put a quota on the number of black fans that were allowed to attend the games. Robinson had a bit of a slump at the beginning of the Little World Series. He went 0-for-5 in game one. And he only went 1-for-10 in the first three games. But his bat picked up when he returned home to Montreal. And down 2-1 in the series, the Royals won the next three games and won the series. Robinson drove in the game winner in the 10th inning of game four in extra innings. And after they clinched the series in game six and they won the Little World Series, and of course, all the fans knew that Jackie was headed to the major leagues. He was headed to Brooklyn to break the color barrier the following year. And the fans in Montreal mobbed him after the game. They lifted him up on their shoulders. They hugged him. They kissed him. They tore at his clothes. And it was just an incredible scene of love. And in fact, Sam Malton, who covered this game for the Pittsburgh Courier, he wrote that there were tears in Robinson's eyes when they lifted him up and just carried him off the field. And what an incredible story. And that almost brings a tear to my eye right now, actually. It makes me proud really thinking about this. And to this day, of course, the Montreal Expos Major League Baseball team no longer exists. And one day, hopefully, baseball will come back to the city of Montreal. But there's only one statue outside of Olympic Stadium in Montreal where the Montreal Expos used to play. And it's not of Gary Carter, Expos legend, who went on to play with the Mets as well. It's not Andre Dawson, the Hawk, who obviously went on to also star with the Cubs later in his career and win the MVP in the National League. The only statue outside of Olympic Stadium in Montreal is of Jackie Robinson. And so we remember him and the incredible achievement that he was able to make in breaking the color barrier on this day in 1947. And a lot of it was due to his faith in Christ, which enabled him to turn the other cheek and to make the sacrifices he needed to get it done. So, wow, amazing story. We'll be right back on the Cale Clark Show, 1-888-914-9149.
Helping you keep your mind off traffic and on the more important things in life. It's Cale Clark on Relevant Radio.
Hey, welcome back to the show. 1-888-914-9149 is the toll-free number to call if you want to call in and talk to me. In just a few moments, I'm going to be joined by the CEO of Relevant Radio, Father Rocky Hoffman, live and in studio. I can't wait for that. But just as we're waiting for Father Rocky to make his way over, I do have to tell you that there was a Twitter user who took umbrage, took a little bit of an issue with a video I had linked to. It's from my YouTube channel. And I had done a whole show about this. I did a very, very brief YouTube video about James and the ossuary of James and the resurrection appearance that Jesus made to him. You'll remember the show that I did about that just a few days ago. And this Twitter user, he goes by the handle Evidentialism. Evidentialism. And I don't know what his real name is, but he linked to a YouTube video that he had about, it's basically debunking, trying to debunk Jesus from a historical perspective. And I'm telling you, I could do about 10 shows in response to this video. I was just like, wow. And I've dealt with a lot of these questions on the show, the historical evidence for Jesus outside the Bible. Anyways, one of the things that he mentioned, which I don't think I've ever talked about on the show, but I thought it was a good chance maybe to talk about it because we've got a couple of minutes here before Father Rocky arrives. One of the things that this guy mentioned in his video was that there are figures from the past, and is often alleged that Christians borrowed stuff from these guys. For example, stuff from the quote-unquote mystery religions, or details from the life of people like Apollonius of Tyana. And they basically copied it and sort of made up this story of Jesus based on these mystery religions, people like Apollonius. Let me just deal with Apollonius for a minute. We'll talk about the mystery religions another time, but I don't know if you've ever heard of Apollonius of Tyana. And this person is roughly contemporaneous with Jesus. He lived in the first century. Sounds an awful lot like Jesus. He is said to have healed people. People also say that he exorcised demons out of people. It is said that he raised someone from the dead, a young girl, and that he even appeared to some of his followers after his death. So some people say, well, okay, if you think this guy's legendary and he didn't really exist or he never really did these things, well then, couldn't the same thing be said about Jesus? All right, let me just tell you a little bit about this guy, Apollonius of Tyana, who may have been a real person. First of all, we have one biography of Apollonius, and it's by this guy named Philostratus. Now, when did he write this? Philostratus wrote his life of Apollonius about a century and a half after the life of Apollonius of Tyana. Now, that is a lot different from the Gospels and the other writings in the New Testament that were all written within one generation of Jesus' life and go way back to the time of Jesus. And if we have time later in the show, I'll tell you that there are a lot of people living still when the Gospels were written who knew Jesus and who had been healed by him. So if there was phony stuff in the Gospels, they certainly would have known about it, to be sure. Another thing is we have multiple sources about the life of Jesus, not only the Gospels, the writings of St. Paul. We have people outside the Bible who wrote about Jesus, like Josephus, Tacitus, other historians. With this guy Apollonius, we have one source, and it comes from a century and a half after his life. On top of that, why did this guy write this book about Apollonius? Why did Philostratus write this biography? Well, he was paid to do it. He was paid to do it by an empress who was actually trying to dedicate and build a temple to Apollonius of Tyana. So she paid Philostratus to write a biography of him. So he had a financial motive to make the story really, really good and maybe embellish it a little bit. Now, that's not the case with the writers of the Gospels. They didn't make up stories about Jesus doing miracles. They didn't make up the account of his resurrection. There was nothing in it for them except for martyrdom. They had no motive, no personal anything to gain from doing this, no ulterior motives. Also, this biography of Apollonius of Tyana, it includes a lot of statements like, it is reported that, it's all just a bunch of hearsay. Some say the young girl died. Others say she was just ill. Maybe he didn't really bring her back to life. And Philostratus, by the way, was writing, guess where, in the 3rd century in Cappadocia. The church was already there for a long, long time. So if anybody was doing any borrowing, it was Philostratus borrowing from the account of Jesus and maybe reading those things, making up stuff in the life of Apollonius that sounds like Jesus. In other words, Jesus came first. So the borrowing was done by these guys, not by the Christians. All right. And by the way, even if all the stuff about Apollonius of Tyana is in fact true, that has nothing to do with the evidence for the life, the death, the resurrection, the miracles. It has nothing to do with the evidence for Jesus. You have to deal with that separately. You still have to deal with all the evidence for Christ, and there's a ton of it. So that is nothing to worry about at all. And no, the church did not borrow from this guy, Apollonius, to construct some life of Jesus. That really happened, and the Jesus story happened first. So, all right, we've run out of time on that because I'm joined right now by the CEO of Relevant Radio, Father Rocky Hoffman. And Father Rocky, how are you today?
Hey, Cale, how you doing?
I'm doing well, but I gotta say, I'm wondering about how you're doing because I have to say that on a day like this, you probably still get the nervous twitches from way back in your days as an accountant, because today used to be, you know, it was tax day, and normally it would be tax day this year, right, if not for COVID.
It is. You're right about that. So April 15th is usually the deadline for getting personal taxes in, and then I think it was a month or two later for corporate taxes, and then for not-for-profit mm-hmm. taxes. It was in August, so I remember that. That was intense. And here's something really humorous about that. There's only one time in my life when I failed to get my tax return in on time. And that's when I was a guest speaker for a Catholic radio gala in Indianapolis, because there's a Catholic radio station down there. And the guy who runs it is also he's also a CPA. I worked for a CPA firm. I never got the CPA certificate because I went to the seminary before I could get it. But, you know, I worked in that to pass the exam and all that. And we just both left because he had their event on April 15th. I said, "Did you get your taxes?" And he said, "No." I said, "Neither am I." That's how consuming Catholic radio was. But now I've learned how to do it easier with an electronic submission.
Yeah,
it's really simple.
You got it, EFI. Well, I promise this will not be a taxing interview today,
good.
Father. And by the way, I didn't come up with that pun. That was Jake Moore, so I got to give him credit. Well, let me ask you about this. You're here to talk about not the tax season, of course, but
right.
The Walk to Mary. For those people listening out there who don't know anything about it, what is the Walk to Mary? Where are they going? What's this all about?
Good. So thank you for this, and thanks that we got this set up, because I had it on my schedule, and then I was working at my desk and said, "Oh, my goodness, I got to go on Cale's show in a few minutes." So it's great. We've got Luke here and Jake. I just walk in, sit down, put the headphones on, and here we go. So the Walk to Mary is just what it says. People walk to a shrine where the Blessed Mother is honored. And the shrine is not too far from here. It's about 20 miles from where I am today in Green Bay. It's called the Shrine of Our Lady of Good Help, H-E-L-P, Our Lady of Good Help. And they've got a website. And then the organization that organizes this annual walking pilgrimage is called Walk to Mary. You can go to their website, walktomary.com. And there's a prayer card that people get the day they show up to the pilgrimage on the back. And I couldn't find it, but I know sort of the gist of it. It sort of captures the biblical sense of pilgrimage. Pilgrimage is you're walking or traveling to a holy place. And as far as I can tell, the first pilgrimage is in the Old Testament. Abraham is walking to a holy place to offer sacrifice. That'll be the Mount Moriah. And then in the time of Jesus, they made a pilgrimage every year from their little town up in the mountains in Galilee, Nazareth, all the way down to Jerusalem. And they'd walk there. It took the better part of a week to walk. They'd stay there for the festival. They'd walk back. It was the annual pilgrimage. And then during the Middle Ages, Christians went on pilgrimage from all different parts of Europe. They would walk to the shrine of St. James in the northwest of Spain. And
Camino.
To walk is the verb to walk in Spanish is Camino, and that's the Camino to Santiago. And there are many different pathways to get there. It's not just one road, right? And people still do that today. They may walk for a day. They may walk for a month. They may walk for 6 months. They also would go to Rome or to the Holy Land in the Middle Ages. And then in our own time, John Paul II would literally go on pilgrimage to all over the world to bring Christ to people. And in Catholic countries like Poland or the Philippines or in Mexico, Italy, people still have this custom of doing a 1 or 2 or 3 day, maybe even a 5 day walking pilgrimage to some holy place. So the Polish go to Częstochowa in Poland. But here in Chicago, Chicago's 3 hours south of here, and the Polish Catholics and people on the south side, they'll do a 2 day walking pilgrimage to the Shrine of Our Lady of Częstochowa on the northwest part of Indiana. Or people will go to Lourdes or Fatima or Guadalupe or Lady of Loreto. And this particular version of a walking pilgrimage started back in 2011. There was a men's conference here in Green Bay called the Estovir, which is Latin for be a man, mm-hmm. yeah. conference, which is familiar to me because that's a phrase that St. Jose Maria mm-hmm. used. That's where right. they got their name from a book that St. Jose Maria wrote. You know, he said, hey, quit complaining, be a man, get a man up, right?
Yeah.
So I was asked to be the MC at that conference. And just a few months earlier, on December 8th, the year 2010, the new bishop of Green Bay, Bishop David Rickon, who's still the bishop here, mm-hmm. had officially approved an apparition that had been reported to have taken place at this shrine back in 1859. Now, this is highly unusual.
Right? Yeah, it is.
This isn't something a bishop does every day. And in fact, most bishops never do something like this. But when he came in, the former bishop, Bishop David Subek, said, you know, you really ought to take a look into this, what's going on out there. And so Bishop Rickon set up a qualified and bona fide theological commission of three theologians to mm-hmm. investigate what had taken place in there. And after a two-year study, their conclusion was that the only way you can explain what's been going on here for the last 150 years is there's something supernatural in origin that took place there. So he officially approved that. And I was there. Relevant Radio broadcast live that event. We were the only media broadcasting live that declaration because I certainly had a sense of the historical significance of it. So when I was at this men's conference 4 months later, mm-hmm. at the end of the conference, they say, hey, guys, I want to say something that's not on the schedule. Boy, did that get their attention. I'm about to do something you're not supposed to do. And that really got their attention. And I said, what I'm going to do is I have an idea and I am not taking ownership for it. I simply don't have the time or energy to, but I've got an idea. And the idea is somebody needs to organize on a yearly basis a one-day walking pilgrimage from Green Bay, I think I said from Relevant Radio, to the Shrine of Our Lady of Good Hope. I said, because this is what Christians do in the month of May. They go on a walking penitential pilgrimage to some Shrine of Our Lady. And that, you know, being a priest of Opus Dei, I know that very well because St. Jose Maria left that as kind of a tradition we do. So I've been doing this for the past 40 years, 45 years, every year in the month of May, go somewhere to a Shrine of Our Lady. But I'd never thought of walking 23 miles in one day. You know, our penance was drive to a place and not stop at McDonald's on the way back. So I just tossed the idea out there, said, you know, the Polish mm-hmm. do it, the Filipinos do it, the Italians do it, the Mexicans do it. You know, can we do that in this country, in the secularized America? Can we motivate people to take off the whole day? And there's always going to be excuses like it's too hot, it's too cold, it's too wet, it's too dry. There's finals coming up. I got prom tomorrow. You know, I just bought some land. I got to see it. I just married a wife. I've got to go talk to her. I just got some cows. I said, there's always going to be excuses, right? Mm-hmm. But let's see, you know. So I thought that was the end of it. Well, about a year later, two fellas, Pat Depre from the Green Bay area and his friend Tom Schmidt, they organized it completely on their own, right? So they started a little 501c3 corporation, and it's all volunteer work. And it takes a lot to organize something like this because you actually walk through three or four civil jurisdictions and maybe even two different counties. So mm-hmm. you got to get everybody involved, right? Police and fire, medical personnel. And it gets even more complicated with COVID.
Porta-potties.
Yeah, porta-potties. So it's very, very well organized. There's water along the way. There's porta-potties. Mm-hmm. There's food. There's safety and all that. So the first year, I don't know, a couple hundred people came out. The next mm-hmm. year, 300 or 400 people. But the last couple of years, 2,000 people have come out.
That's amazing.
This year, I think they're going to have more than 2,000. And so what do you do? You walk. And what do you do when you walk? You breathe. You talk. You sing songs. You pray a rosary. You offer up the pain and the soreness in your muscles to God. People come with an intention. I met a young woman there a couple of years ago. She had a little baby in a carriage and a newborn baby. And I said, I think I met your parents on the walk here today. Are you the one who came here last year? She said, yes, I am. She had had five miscarriages. Can you imagine how devastating that is?
Oh.
Five miscarriages. So she did the 23-mile walk praying that she would be blessed to have a baby, and a year later she had a baby. So everybody's got their own plans there. Like, oh, this other couple I met after Mass there 2 years ago, mm-hmm. mom and a dad and 12-year-old boy, smiling, and I didn't know who they were, and they wanted to talk to me. And said, don't you remember? I said, help me out. You know, we called into the show and you know, our marriage was on the rocks. And you said, well, let's pray. And you need to go to the Shrine of Our Lady of Good Help and you need to do the walk. And he said, we came, we did the walk, and we've saved our marriage, right?
So wow.
It's really, really powerful.
That is amazing.
So I think at least once in your life, it needs to be on your bucket list. Now, yeah. you might be saying, Father, there's no way I can walk 23 miles. Hey, I got good news for you. You don't have to walk 23 miles. You could walk 14. I still can't do 14. Okay, you can do 7. I'm not sure I can do 7, right? You can do 2.
Yeah.
Right, so there's 4 starting points. At the end of the day, a wonderful Mass with Bishop David Ricken, who's the Bishop of Green Bay, out at the shrine. You can light a candle. You can do it for your own, whatever you want. And it's really, really well organized. So find out all about it at walktomary.com. Now, read the directions, folks, if you're coming. I didn't read the directions the first year. And so by the time I arrived there, I had blisters on my heels the size of silver dollars.
Wow, you had a lot to offer up that day.
Oh, my goodness.
So what day is this happening
in May
this year?
It's always the first Saturday in May.
First Saturday in May, which is
May 1st. Knock on wood, the weather has always been fabulous. You know where knock on wood comes from?
I don't.
It's the wood of the cross, which saved the world. Knock on wood. How about
that? I like that. I learned something new.
There you go.
Well, tell us really quickly, Father, because I know when you first heard about this, you were like maybe a little skeptical about this personally. Tell us about Sister Adele, and she's not the singer Adele, of course, Sister Adele and these apparitions of Our Lady.
I arrived to Green Bay in 2009 working for LM Radio, some of the folks here said, hey, Father, did you hear about the apparition of Our Lady about 20 miles from here out in the woods? Well, I hadn't heard about it, and, you know, people tell me about apparitions all the time.
Yeah.
And I believe, but I also know that sometimes people get caught up in...
Sometimes.
You know, what should I say? You know, they see apparitions everywhere.
And
the church is very...
Piece of toast and...
Yeah, the church is very deliberate in investigating things. So anyway, I just kind of kept that to myself and didn't think much more about it. But after 9 months, I decided I'm going to drive out there and see what this is about.
Hmm.
We went out in the month of May to make a little May pilgrimage. And it's out there in the countryside in Dairyland, right between 2 active dairy farms. And when we walked into the church, my immediate sense was, oh, wow, this is real. And why did I have that sense? Well, because it was quiet. And the Blessed Sacrament was right in the center and illuminated with a veil on it. And the floor was squeaky clean. And there was nothing weird going on there. There was a confessional in the background, maybe 2 other people in it. There wasn't a crowd, right? Some vigil candles lit, and it just everyone who goes to the Shrine of Our Lady of Good Help in Champaign, Wisconsin, always remarks, it's so peaceful here.
Wow.
It is so peaceful. And I was talking to one of the guys who works at the Shrine just this morning. He said, you know, over the last couple of weeks, they've been having confessions like 5 or 6 hours a day. So that's a real good sign of the authenticity of this place. And so this is our apparition for America. It's the only approved apparition of the Blessed Mother in the whole history of the United States. And so in that sense, it's like our Fatima, our Lourdes, our Guadalupe.
Wow. Yeah, that is absolutely amazing. So the website is walktomary.com. And if you go to that website, you can actually watch a little video featuring Father Rocky and the 2 gentlemen he mentioned earlier who started this incredible journey. And I think it's great. I wish I could travel to Wisconsin so I could do it with you. The day will come, and we'll get those blisters, and I'll share in the pain.
No, but you don't have to get the blisters if you read the directions. You read the directions. It says, change your socks every 7 miles, and maybe put a little moleskin, you know, behind your toes and on the heel. And the other thing is take 1 Advil every 7 miles, and stay hydrated, and you'll be fine. You'll be tired, but you'll be fine.
Yeah, absolutely.
So read the directions. Don't be a guy. Read the directions.
Yeah, that's always good advice. Absolutely. Well,
hey, how's your show going?
I don't know. It's going great today because you're here. So you've always got great stories and great radio.
I love your show.
Sometimes
at home in Chicago, right about your showtime, I get on the extra cycle.
I put the
earbuds in my ear and I listen to your show. You had that story a couple weeks ago about Pope Pius X, a little girl from Ireland, wanting to receive communion. I was mesmerized by that. And Cardinal Mary Del Valle.
Yeah, Cardinal Mary Del Valle. Yeah, the Litany of Humility, which I have prayed. It's a very dangerous prayer, and I've had many chances to practice that over the years. Let's put it that way. And yeah, mm-hmm. Little Nellie of Holy God. What an inspiring story that was. Yeah, I learned a lot from her and about devotion and about piety, and hopefully we can all be a little bit more pious, a little bit more holy, and walking to Mary on May 1st is a great way to get closer to Our Lady in this month of May. Father Rocky, it's always great to run you down. I know you've got to get on the exercise bike, so I won't take up any more of your precious time. And thanks for popping in. Really appreciate you.
Thanks, Kelly. You're doing a great job. We're lucky to have you on Relevant Radio.
Oh, you're very kind. Thank you. God bless. All right. Well, we're going to walk. It's not 500 miles. Don't worry. It's not that far. But you can walk and get closer to God as you do it. We'll be right back. 1-888-914-9149. Catholic Order of Foresters is proud to sponsor the Relevant Radio studio line. For information about employment opportunities and flexible premium life insurance plans, visit relevantradio.com/Forester.
Helping you keep your mind off traffic and on the more important things in life. It's Cale Clark on Relevant Radio.
Hey, welcome back. Don't forget, tomorrow on the show, it's an AMA session. You can ask me anything, so get in those questions. You can email us, kale@relevantradio.com. You can also tweet at me your question, at Cale Clark's my Twitter handle. You can follow me there. And we have a show account, too, at Cale Clark Show. The phone number to call, 1-888-914-9149. We're going to go into our last segment right now. And here's a question that's often asked of me. When were the Gospels written? Now, that's an important question because some skeptics claim that the Gospels are completely unreliable because they were written too long after the fact. I talked to you earlier in the show about this story about Apollonius of Tyana, this account of his life, but it was written a century and a half after he lived. Well, that's too long to be considered reliable history. And a lot of people think that's true of the Gospels as well, that they were written too long after the life of Jesus to give us any reliable history about him. Here's an example just of one particular person who claims this, who gets in the news a lot, Bart Ehrman, who's a very skeptical New Testament scholar. He's a legit scholar. He studied under Bruce Metzger, the famous textual critic of the New Testament. And he knows what he's doing. Bart Ehrman knows his stuff. And he says in his book, How Jesus Became God, this is what Bart Ehrman said. And by the way, Dr. Craig Evans, some other scholars, penned a rebuttal book to Bart's book. And they called their book, How God Became Jesus. So it's like, okay, well, if you're going to say how Jesus became God, implying that he's not God, well, in actuality, the opposite is true. God became Jesus. Well, anyways, Bart Ehrman says that the gospel authors had no intention of presenting biographical information about what Jesus really said and what Jesus really did. He thinks that the accounts of Jesus' career were simply passed down orally through the spoken word for many decades before they were ever written down in the gospels. And he thinks that by this point, it was almost like a game of telephone in which the gospels became super embellished with details that didn't really happen. And in their final form, they bear little to no resemblance to what actually took place during Jesus' public life, during the years between AD 30 and AD 33. Well, is that the case? Is that the case? Well, not according to the Gospels themselves. Luke claims at the beginning of his Gospel, if you read the beginning of Luke, he's dedicating his Gospel and also Volume 2 of his work, The Acts of the Apostles, to this person named Theophilus. And that may not be his real name. We don't really know. Theophilus means lover of God, so it could just be someone who loved God. Or it could be an actual name. It's possible. But Luke says, I carefully investigated everything from the beginning. He did his research, did his homework. Well, Bart Ehrman says that, and if you read most textbooks, introductions to the New Testament, a lot of scholars say the same thing that he does. He thinks that the Gospels were composed with Mark starting off probably around the year 70 AD, Matthew and Luke written in the 70s or possibly the 80s in the first century, John in the 90s, possibly as late as AD 95. And Bart Ehrman is confident that this 40 to 60 year gap between Jesus' life and the appearance of the Gospels greatly lessens the probability that they have accurate information about him. However, there is another view. There is another way of looking at that. And this is now reasserting itself on the scene. This actually was the view of a scholar named John A.T. Robinson years and years ago. He said, you know what? I think the Gospels are written a lot earlier than most scholars think. And John Robinson actually said that the entire New Testament was composed prior to the year A.D. 70. Why? Well, one simple reason. Not one of the 27 books in the New Testament mentions the destruction of the Jerusalem temple by the Romans in the year 70 AD. That was a cataclysmic event for the Jews. It was like the end of the world for them. Now you might say, well, hang on here. Didn't Jesus prophesy the destruction of the temple in the Gospels? Yeah, he did. But it wasn't prophecy after the fact. A lot of people say, well, the Gospels are written late and they're writing these words in, they're putting words in the mouth of Jesus about him prophesying about the temple's destruction. But that's not what happened at all. In fact, if that's what they were trying to do, the evangelist did a terrible job. Because when Jesus was prophesying the destruction of the temple, he said the stones of the temple would be thrown down. But that's not what happened. In actuality, the temple was burned to the ground in a towering inferno. Now, if the gospel writers were aware of how the temple was destroyed, they're writing very late, they would have mentioned that because, you know, fire is a well-known image of judgment. They certainly would have used that. So I don't think that's the case. I think that John A.T. Robinson was right, that all the New Testament books are written early, prior to the year 70, because it just boggles my mind that they wouldn't mention the destruction of the temple, especially when you consider there was the temple authorities that got Jesus killed. They would say, look, this is God's judgment on the temple establishment. You see what happened? You know, you rejected Jesus and there you go. Now the temple lies in ruins. They wouldn't have ignored that, trust me. But there's some other reasons the Gospels were probably written earlier. For example, the Acts of the Apostles, where does it end off? Paul's in Rome. He's under house arrest. He's awaiting trial. It's highly doubtful that Luke, the author of the Acts of the Apostles, he was the traveling companion of St. Paul, for goodness sake. It's just impossible that he wouldn't talk about the martyrdom of Paul, his good friend, the central figure of the Acts of the Apostles, unless he was writing this book before Paul was martyred in 64 AD. So if the Acts of the Apostles was written before 64 AD, that must mean that Luke was written even earlier. And by the way, Luke depends on Mark. So Mark had to be written even earlier than that. So don't forget also Paul's letters were earlier than the Gospels, written prior to any of the Gospels in all likelihood. So they are very, very close in time to the events of the life of Jesus. And here's a little experience that I had that might shed some light on this too for modern minds. When I was visiting San Diego before the pandemic, my family and I took a side trip to go see Torrey Pines, the beautiful golf course that hugs the Pacific Coast. The U.S. Open is going to be played there this year. I'm a big golf fan. I wanted to see this course. I actually got to play it. It was awesome. But not far from Torrey Pines, we stumbled upon this beautiful veterans monument, and it honored those who gave their lives in the Vietnam War, which ended in 1975. Now, we all know that there are many Vietnam veterans who are still alive today, and they still vividly remember their tours of duty. Well, the period of time that's elapsed since the Vietnam War until the present day is pretty much exactly the time frame that's elapsed from the ministry of Jesus until when the Gospels were written and circulating around, about 40 years. Now, nobody today would be able to offer some bogus account of Vietnam without being completely discredited because they're living witnesses of Vietnam. If somebody wrote a false story about the war, they'd say, no, that never happened. I was there. The same thing happened with the Gospels. There were eyewitnesses who were alive when the Gospels were written who had experienced the ministry of Jesus. And they would have, if false stories about Jesus were circulating, it never would have got off the ground. Never would have got off the ground. Paul says in 1 Corinthians, 500 people, over 500 people who witnessed the resurrected Christ were still alive. You could interview them. A New Testament scholar named Robert McIver says that there would have been up to 63,000 adult witnesses to Jesus' public career, with 18,000 to 20,000 of them still living after 30 years' time. So this is amazing. So there are people kicking around who could have refuted the Gospels if they weren't true. There's a guy named Quadratus. He was an early apologist. You probably haven't heard of this guy. He lived from the year 70 AD to 130 AD, into the second century. He said that eyewitnesses to Jesus' ministry were alive in his time. So this is quite late. Just like the Acts of the Apostles says, this was not done in a corner. This wasn't done in a galaxy far, far away. Jesus' ministry was public. These are public events, and people who observed these things saw it, and they lived for many, many decades afterwards, and they would never have let the truth be swallowed up in any kind of legend. So hopefully that's helpful to you. Well, you can ask me questions about that. You can ask me questions about anything tomorrow. It's an AMA session tomorrow on Friday on the Cale Clark Show, so be sure to email us, cale@relevantradio.com. You can tweet at me at Cale Clark, or the show account at Cale Clark Show, or call us 1-888-914-9149. I want to hear your questions, and I can't wait. I want to thank my guest, Father Rocky Hoffman, CEO of Relevant Radio, for joining me today to talk about the walktomary.com, which is happening on May 1st. Check it out. I want to thank Lucas Holt for producing, Karen Moran for working social media, and Jake Moore, Jake the Snake, screen calls today. Timmy's up next. Take it away, Michaela.
Thank you for listening to my daddy.